is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we are responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're ready.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Well, hello, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Stuart, it's great to have you back.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Been a while.
It has been a while.
2 days.
Yeah. And Paul's here, too.
It's been the longest week of my life.
Paul's here, too. Hi, Paul. Did you want to tell the audience what this show's about that's creating a lot of extra work for you this week?
No, it's so nice to spend time with my pals for like 10 hours out of the week. It's been good. So this is an internal medicine podcast that uses expert interviews to bring you clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge. And then we also do discuss a little bit about work-life integration at the outset. So if you want to skip past that part, look at the show notes, but then be a lesser person.
This episode was inspired by my first job, where at Cashlack I was working in a largely geriatrics clinic down in Texas. And I constantly got the hallway pounce, as Dr. Pomodoro will tell us about, from family members telling me that I had to take away the driving capability of my patients, which always made me very uncomfortable. I wasn't sure what questions to ask. I wasn't sure what exam things to do or what resources were available. So this show is designed to help point you in the direction of all of those things. Dr. Pomodoro is an absolute expert on the topic. She is a family practice geriatrician who has been actively involved in clinical teaching of medical students, residents, and fellows for over 30 years. She teaches frequently on a variety of topics in geriatrics, including older adult driving, physical activity, nutrition, and falls prevention. She served previously in Ohio as a chief of geriatrics, fellowship director, and as a medical director at multiple retirement and long-term care communities. Dr. Pomodoro is currently a member of the Safe Mobility for Life Coalition in Florida and a former president of the Florida Geriatric Society. She is the editorial board chair for the Clinician's Guide to Assessing and Counseling Older Drivers, published by the American Geriatric Society, which is a free resource that we will talk about on the show. And this was done in collaboration with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. She is also the immediate past chair of the Public Education Committee for the American Geriatric Society and currently works clinically for the Florida State University Senior Health in Tallahassee, Florida. So without further ado, here is our very enjoyable discussion with Dr. Alice Pomodoro.
Take it away, Matt.
Okay. The first question we're going to ask you, Dr. Pomodoro, is always just like, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself? You can do it in the form of a one-liner if you want to. Otherwise, yeah, just tell them, give them a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a 58-year-old family practice-based geriatrics specialist who is married to another physician who teaches. And I have three kids who are all grown and independently out of the house, and one remaining child at home who is a black labramut from the pound.
So that's a dog, right?
Yes. And as opposed to being a labradoodle or a labra something else, she's clearly part lab, but we have no clue what the rest of it is. So she's officially our labramut.
I'm so envious of people that have successfully raised children at someone who's at the like beginning of that hill, because it seems like, I'm not sure I'm going to make it or not, but talking to people like yourself gives me hope.
Oh, sure. You'll make it. You have no choice.
Yep. My wife keeps reminding me about that. Dr. Pomodoro, I wanted to ask you, we always call our guests by their first name, and I forgot to mention that to you in pre-recording. Is it okay if we call you Alice for the purposes of the recording?
Oh, sure.
So, Alice, my co-host will also ask you a couple questions here, and then we'll move on to the main topic.
Okie doke.
Or not. why don't we just sit here in comfortable silence? That also sounds nice. I'll ask, it's been a while since we've done this one, I think, but I'm everyone panics at this, so you can recommend a book that every physician should read, or if failing that, just a book that you liked recently. Either one of those would be a fine answer.
There's a book that I think women should read in general, whether they're physicians or not, which is called A Gift from the Sea by Anne Lindberg, that was written actually decades ago. And it talks about one's role in life as you get older and ways that you can simplify it and appreciate what you are having right now, using the analogy of different shells in life on the beach. And I've probably read that every year for about 20 years now. Just once a year, wow, when I'm at the beach, I read it. It's very short, and it's very helpful for me to gain perspective on the confusion or busyness that I've been experiencing for the rest of the year. So for that's particularly, it's written for women in particular. Anyone could appreciate it, but it's written from an angle for women. In general, I will tell you the most recent book I read, which may make you laugh, but would be particularly applicable, is a child's book called We Don't Eat Our Classmates. It's by Ryan T. Higgins, and it's about a small Tyrannosaurus Rex on her first day of school, and it turns out that she is in a human classroom for the first time. And kind of what happens when she is in this unusual environment and how she relates to her classmates. And it's one of the few books that made me laugh out loud while I was reading it in the store. So even though I have no children at the present time of that age, I just didn't care. I really liked that book, so I bought it.
You're really helping me out, and probably Stuart too. I'm going to the library with my kids tomorrow, so we'll have to look for that one.
It actually sounds like it's my speed too. There's no reason to exclude me. That's about right up my alley.
Oh yeah,
the artwork is amazing.
Paul actually famously has three mediocre sons. I forgot about that, Paul. They're actually cats, Dr. Pomodoro, or Alice. They're actually cats, but he calls them his three mediocre sons.
Yeah, but they are mediocre. There's no getting around that.
We had some listeners who weren't in on that joke that got very offended by Paul calling his children mediocre.
Oh dear. Oh dear.
I stand by it.
Stuart, do you want to move us along here?
Yeah, sure. What's the best advice that you've ever received as a teacher or a learner?
Well, they're quite different, but as a learner, I had a clinician who told me that if I had a patient that I was not looking forward to seeing when I saw their name on my schedule for the day, that probably that was a person I needed to move towards instead of run away from, because the harder you run away, the harder people chase you. And when you go towards, you can often figure out something that will help both of you manage the situation better.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's the first we've heard anything. We've asked this question a lot, and a lot of the answers sometimes seem to blur together. That one's totally different than other answers we've gotten. I like that. I think I noticed that when I had that issue of like seeing patients on my schedule that just gave me the, you know, they call it the heart sink patient, or
yes,
I noticed that I had to learn more about the condition, or just had to do more reading, or run the case with my colleagues to try to get some ideas on how to troubleshoot it. So I guess that's kind of a way of running towards those patients, kind of arming yourself with information or answers or solutions. Oftentimes we don't have solutions for these patients. That's the hard part. But
it's almost invariably that's the patient that needs the most help.
Yeah,
and that's the patient who you have the most to offer to is the one that you actually probably dread seeing the most. So it's great advice.
Often it is patients for whom you may not have a lot of other options to offer, and what the person really needs is to hear that at a regular interval, that you care, that you're trying, and that you want to know if there's anything else you can do for them, and to have them let you know what their needs are and offer to continue to support them in the future as much as you can. Sometimes that's all people need to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've always looked at it as those are the kinds of patients that need you to truly care. That's all that they need is just you to care. And if you approach the patient in that with that kind of a mindset, smile real big. And, you know, maybe it's the kind of patient needs a hug at the end of the visit, or maybe doesn't even want to talk about their high blood pressure or their diabetes. They just want to sit down and talk to you about something. And oftentimes that's cathartic in and of itself.
Well, this topic we're going to talk about today is might be one of those topics where you're like, sorry, still can't let you drive, but I know it's tough.
But well, would you like a hug?
I wanted to start off with, this is actually, this is a case from Cashlack Memorial that's actually, it's based on a real case. One of the members of our Curbsiders team, they have been struggling with a family member. So we'll say this is Alfred, a 94-year-old male. He does not suffer from dementia. He's hard of hearing, doesn't wear hearing aids since he finds them annoying. He was last hospitalized 3.5 years ago for pneumonia. He still drives short distances around town daily. His daughter frequently accompanies him to doctor's appointments, and she's raised the concern about his driving ability, and she couldn't cite any specific examples or issues like based on accidents that she knew about, but she just had the sense that he should not be driving, and that's kind of all the information we have. So the first question I wanted to ask you is, Are these older drivers good at rating their own driving abilities?
That depends some on the driver. There are clearly those people who do have some kind of cognitive impairment and are terrible at recognizing when they need to ratchet down. There are also the people that we all know who have been bad drivers their entire lives. And there's no reason they should improve just because they're getting older. And they also see nothing wrong with their driving style. So excluding those two groups of people, there is actually a good evidence base where they've taken drivers out on the road with what would be considered gold standard testing, which is driver rehab specialists that are certified usually through occupational therapy, and had them rate their own driving, and then also had caregivers rate their driving on a validated tool called the Fitness to Drive screening tool. And despite being cognitively intact or having relatively good insight, most older drivers still do not rate their own driving skills accurately, but interestingly, caregivers do. Now, that's only if the caregiver has been brave enough to actually ride. If the caregiver is coming independently and meeting her dad at Cashlack, well, then I'm sorry, but it doesn't count. You don't get to say someone's not a good driver unless you've actually ridden with them in the car and you can give direct evidence that you have some reason to believe that.
Yeah, that seems fair. I guess you got to give them the benefit of the doubt. How is it usually brought to your attention that somebody is having trouble driving that kind of gets them on your radar?
Oh, there's usually three different scenarios. One is where the older adult says themselves, you know, sort of in casual conversation, well, you know, I don't drive at night anymore. Or I'm sort of worried about, you know, taking those high-speed roads with all the other drivers out there. So I don't do that. And you have some evidence that people have started to self-restrict either where they go, when they go, or how they get there. Then that's worth investigating. Oh, so tell me more about that. Why are you not comfortable driving at night? And those are often, for example, vision problems. The second way that people pop up is when the already been in some kind of an injury and this is their ER follow-up where, well, you know, I was in this fender bender and I went to the ER and they said that if I wasn't any better that I needed to come and see you. So here I am. And then you have to sort of delve into the background of that. The third way that people pop up is the famous hallway pounce, where The person is in the room and you're about to go in, and the family member makes some excuse to hang around outside and not go in the room at the same time, whether it's, I have to go to the bathroom or I'm going to take a phone call. But when they see you coming, then they pounce on you and say, oh, you have to tell them that he can't drive anymore. I don't feel safe with the children, but don't tell them I said so, because they don't want him to be mad. And so you are supposed to somehow figure out how to get all the information after you're in the room without letting on that the family member put you up to it.
And I think from this point on, I've heard you talk about this before at the American College of Physicians national meeting, and I know you gave these five R's of, like, what is the clinician's responsibility. So I was wondering if maybe it would be a good time to say those now, and then we can refer back to them as we're going through the various parts of this evaluation and counseling of the patient.
Sure. That would be a good way to think about it. The first is, when you're seeing someone and you're doing your investigating, you're looking for any factors that are putting the person at increased risk and assessing what that risk is and trying to mitigate or reduce that as much as possible, whether it's medications or medical conditions or anything else that you have direct control over. When you are not able to fix the problem, so to speak, on your own that way, you bring them back, you see how it's going, you revisit those issues, and then you may need to refer out for more help. You may need, for example, to send them to physical therapy or to orthopedics to see what's going on and why they can't turn their neck, or you may need to send someone to neuro to get a better handle on why they're continuing to fall persistently. Then there's also the option at that point, of course, of sending someone to a driving rehab specialist and to OT for a further evaluation of instrumental activities of daily living to help out with life in general for folks, and to start to get a grip on whether or not people are going to need to start to transition out of driving into other ways of remaining mobile. So the third R is resources and providing support for the person to remain mobile if they do need to transition away from driving as much as they used to. And social work and your local area agencies on aging are super helpful for this. If along the way, then, say someone can do that 2 miles to the grocery and back, but if they have to go anywhere else, they really, really should not, then you will probably need to provide advice on under what conditions they should or should not be driving, and back up the recommendations of a driving evaluation, if you do have one, from the driving rehab specialist. Or you may have to recommend that they stop completely. And then the last R would be actually reporting. If someone is not willing to transition out of driving on their own, then you may need to report for that reason, or you may be required to report depending on the state that you live in. Every state has different reporting requirements, and you have to know what those are to know if you are actually in a position where you're legally responsible to be reporting.
Go ahead.
No. So I was just going to kind of sum them up for fun. So it's risk reduction, rechecking and referring, providing resources, driving restriction, and reporting.
So for me, it's so many of my patients are coming either via public transportation or paratransit. And so this is something, blessedly, that does not come up in my own practice too much. I've not had too many hallway pounces. But I guess what I'm wondering is, in the absence of being assaulted by a patient's family member, like, what initially prompts you to ask these questions, and what kind of history do you take for your older adult drivers?
Well, I usually ask people whenever I go in, how did you get here today? And find out whether it was some kind of transit or whether they got a ride or whether there's a daughter. And if they didn't get here themselves, then I follow that up with, and so are you still driving at all? Because people will drive even if they're not doing it to get to you. People will often take transit or paratransit to get to us because they expect something unpleasant to happen that's going to disable them from driving home.
Sure. Usually correct.
And
what are you doing to your patients?
And some people actually see it as an outing, you know. Some people just dress up to the teeth to come in and see you, and they don't want to mess that up, and they're being seen in public by other people. And so this is their outing for the day with it. And if, especially if they're with a family member and they're going to go to lunch and everything, then it's just a waste of time to bring both vehicles. But if people are still driving, and if they're not driving today, I ask, well, why did you decide not to drive today? Or if they are driving, then I'll just ask, well, how's that going? Are you getting everywhere that you need to go? And when are you doing most of your driving? And that tends to let people talk about all the other bad drivers there are in the world and how everything has been their fault. And none of this has ever been their fault. And talk a little bit about the nighttime or ways that they may have self-restricted. So that's one way to get there with it. Other ways then that I will look at is, it's typically I have some excuse to ask about specific things since the last visit. So I do like to ask if people have had any near misses or things that scared them since I saw them last. And again, this is sometimes where you will hear the story of the other guy or the mailbox that just reached out and smacked and sometimes it's because of an event. So especially if it's a hospital follow-up, you know, how are you feeling since then? Or with their medication change since the last time I saw them? Well, this often makes people lightheaded. Have you ever noticed that while you're driving? Or things like, well, since your surgery, did your surgeon say that you were strong enough to drive yet? This was, for example, another cashlack patient who came in a full-length leg brace on his right leg, who drove himself in having had knee surgery and a fracture repair 2 weeks earlier. And I said, well, how did you get here? And he said, I drove. And I was like, well, did you use your other leg or something? He goes, no, I used my right leg. Proceeded to demonstrate how he was just kind of hitching his hip up on the side. It was sort of like chair dancing, you know? And I asked, well, didn't anyone tell you that you shouldn't be driving until that brace is off? And he goes, oh, no, nobody said a word. Not a word.
Yeah, they probably didn't think they had to, but I had a similar patient. She was in a cam boot, which you can't plantar flex or dorsiflex in those. And she got in a car accident, and her son and I were just like, "Why were you driving?" And she's like, "Well, no one said I couldn't drive." We're like, "Well, how did you think you were going to operate the gas and the?" And she's like, "Oh, I thought I could use my other foot, and it didn't work out well." So
obviously not.
We also found out that a car dealership had sold her three cars for three accidents within the past like 2 years. So that was a very interesting case.
That was at Cashlack North?
It was Cashlack South, back when I was at Cashlack South, actually. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm not surprised. Not surprised at all.
Yep. Okay, so I derailed things here. You were sort of telling us about some what are some red flags that you look for in the history? Obviously, you just told us one, someone not recognizing
a car accident,
or someone using someone not recognizing that a leg brace makes it dangerous for them to drive.
Yes, lack of insight is an issue. Mm-hmm. If actually there is any concern or lack of insight being displayed, I will ask, well, has anyone been bothering you about driving? Because actually, if a caregiver or family member or friend of any kind has expressed concern about the person's driving, that is actually considered a red flag. because people are, as you know, rather reluctant to criticize other folks driving with the ensuing verbal output that will usually occur afterwards. So to have someone actually start an argument or make an observation about someone's driving usually indicates that there's been really some pretty good reason for it, and it's worth looking into. Other red flags would be post-hospitalization, any acute event, especially things that could induce syncope or cognitive changes like myocardial infarctions, stroke, brain injury, new onset of conditions, especially like AFib and other arrhythmias that aren't controlled yet, orthostatic hypotension when we do their vitals, and histories of falls, which all the same things that make you fall are increasingly shown to also be the same things that make you have driving problems. Recent surgery, seizures, and lots of hypoglycemic episodes or uncontrolled sleep apnea. Those are the biggies.
Yeah. So it's like for the complex internal medicine or geriatric patient with multimorbidity, it's like they have these things.
They do. And so you may look at this and listen to what I said and go, but this is everyone.
Yes, that's all my patients.
So that tells me we need to be addressing this issue with all our older adult patients. And so back to Mr. or to Alfred here, our 94-year-old. So he has a red flag. His family members worried about it. And what can we do like in the clinic, or what practically can you do in the clinic or at the bedside to kind of test these people?
Well, there are three major areas that you want to screen. One is cognition, one is vision, and one is musculoskeletal ability to actually operate a vehicle. And it's not very hard. With the musculoskeletal, you pretty much want people to do a functional range of motion of their arms. So having them reach up and clasp their hands behind their head and their hands behind their back, and then try to turn their head and put their chin on each shoulder and see how well they do. And then do a get up and go, where they get up out of a chair without using their hands, walk 10 feet, walk back, sit down, and you time it. And if it's longer than 10 seconds, then something needs to be investigated for stability and for coordination. For vision, your old-fashioned Snellen chart is important because 20/70 is still the cutoff for most states in terms of acuity, and then doing a visual field confrontation. If you want to have a audience participation moment here, what you could do is take your hands and put them all the way straight out at your sides to the point and see if you can see your fingers wiggle on both sides while you're looking straight ahead. If you can, you have 180-degree field of vision with it. If you can't, then you should move your arms forward until you can see your fingers wiggle. Now, that's an absolutely rock solid normal. Now, if you then, instead of doing that, take your arms and place them so that your elbows are just outside where your knees would be if you planted them on the floor at about shoulder width. You know, if you planted your feet there, don't plant your knees. We're not going to make folks get on their knees. But planted your feet on the floor just outside your knees, that is a 70-degree field of vision. People do not spontaneously notice that much field loss until it gets that bad.
Wow.
And if it gets that bad, it doubles their crash risk. Wow. And that's because we scan. You know, people are always turning their heads, moving their eyes, looking around. So people literally do not notice that they have lost that much of their visual field until they get to that point. You can pick it up when you just do plain old visual field confrontation testing, but a patient won't notice that on their own. And then the third area with cognition, there's a couple of different screens that you can do in the office. Some of them have been specifically validated for driving. The Mini Mental is not one that has been validated for driving. And in fact, in addition to it now being proprietary and costing money, it's been literally shown to not correlate with driving ability at all.
Take that, MMSE.
Well, you know, it's great for looking at cognition in general, but it just doesn't have much that helps you out in terms of frontal ability, executive function, and abstract sequencing, which is needed. It does have a little bit of visual spatial, but not much. And a better test, if you only have time to do one thing, is to do a clock. A good old-fashioned clock.
My favorite.
And to do those every year, because you can see a lot of changes over time. But you have to be able to sequence and plan ahead to be able to do that. You have to have pretty intact visual spatial integrity to do that. You have to be capable of retaining abstract reasoning to remember what numbers are and what they mean. And you have to be able to at least have good enough visual acuity and reading sense to be then able to read your clock and see if it's correct or not.
Yeah. Could you give concrete instructions to the audience on like how you get someone to do a clock drawing?
Oh, sure. I ask, and I usually do what's called actually a mini cog.
Right, with the three question
instead.
Recall.
Yeah, so I'll give people their three words before asking them to draw their clock. And please write them down so that you remember the three words that you gave them. And then you ask them to draw a circle and put the numbers on the face of a clock, and then give people a minute or two to do that, and then tell them, please place the hands at one of two times. You can either use 10 after 11 o'clock, or you can use 20 after 8 o'clock. And those times are specifically chosen because they require the person drawing the clock to use both sides. And it's not an over-rehearsed or an overly well-known time that people can do automatically, like 9 to 5. Almost anyone, even in moderate states of dementia, can put the hands in at 9 o'clock. But having to put it in at an atypical time, that means they have visual fields intact and are not neglecting one side or the other, is important with using those two times. And then you rate those according to, you know, is there a circle? Are the numbers in the right spot? Are the numbers all there? And is the time correct? And so usually you can pretty much do, oh, good clock, bad clock. You don't have to do advanced scoring.
Yeah. Yes. It's one of my favorite, it's just one of my favorite tests. So I've done it in front of family members where I just say, like, I ask mom or dad to draw a clock and they're just like shocked. They're like, come on, mom, dad, draw the clock. Like what's wrong with you? Like they might not even have noticed that there was this level of an issue, but the patient will make an excuse like, oh, I'm tired, or I didn't eat breakfast yet. Or I didn't have my coffee yet today, something like that. So I want to just recap for the audience. The first thing you do is give them the three things to recall, right? And then you have them draw the clock, and then you retest the recall after the clock.
Yes. And then you ask, what were the three words I gave you?
And with the clock drawing, they draw the circle, they put the numbers in, and then you give them the time and see if they can draw the hands on. You don't give them all the instructions at once, like draw a clock, draw all the numbers, and set the time to this. Because that seems like a lot of instructions, but...
Well, what you are doing when you do that is you're really testing a three-step command and their memory. You're not really actually testing the ability to draw the clock.
I see.
You're testing whether or not they can remember directions.
Okay.
So it's not quite fair.
Okay. So you just give it one step at a time. Draw the circle. Now draw the numbers. Now draw the hands on the clock.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm sorry. I know it seems like a small thing, but I don't know that I was doing it. I was giving them all three steps at one time, so I was doing it wrong. I don't know if anyone in our audience was, but I think it's hopefully people will do it right.
Well, almost all of us get into the habit of doing things like cognitive testing a certain way, and usually we sort of shortcut them for reasons of time and convenience and our ability to remember what we're supposed to do.
This is the latter for me.
Yeah, it helps every now and then to check back on it. Now, the one that I really like is there's one which is actually a maze. It's called the Snellgrove maze, and there's three or four of them that you can print out. They get a test maze to see if they can do it or not, and the second piece is a bigger, more complicated maze, and you time how long it takes them to do it, and you see how many times they get stuck in dead ends or hit the walls of the maze while they're trying to solve the puzzle. And if they take longer than 30 seconds, they pretty much flunk. And if they make more than 7 crashes and dead ends, then they pretty much flunk. And that is actually an evidence-based one which has been validated against on the road crash risk and an evaluation, again, by a driving rehab specialist in people with early dementia or mild cognitive impairment. You can get these things, by the way, out of the Clinician's Guide to Assessing and Counseling Older Drivers, for which there is a PDF and chapter-by-chapter links online, as well as an app, so you can have it on your phone if you want.
Yes, I was going to plug that at some point in the show. So I guess now's a good time. Today I went to it. It's the American Geriatric Society website, and I just had to register for free, and I got access to the whole book, which is, as you said, hyperlinked and very well organized. And then from the app, you can bring up like the algorithm that I guess what we'll talk about. We're sort of going through it now, but we can refer back at the end. And then a lot of great handouts within the app as well. And we're not getting paid to mention the app. I just think it's a great resource, so I wanted to mention it to the audience.
Thanks very much. And it is free. So all of it's free because it was developed under a grant with the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And part of their conditions for everything is that it's all free. So the handouts, the app, the book, and all that. And we are actually updating it for release, we hope, in the next 6 months.
Awesome. We'll put the link. We'll put the link in the show notes, and that should be. It goes to the general site, so it should, even when you release the new book, it should still be an up to date link. Stuart, did you have any questions here about the exam before we kind of move on?
No, not really. I think the biggest questions I have are more in relation to history and how not to feel like you're isolating the family members if they feel like they're coming in from as an outsider. There's a lot of concerns for reprisal and, what you'd recommend, how to deal with that dynamic in the exam room at that time, or if there's anything you can say or do to help alleviate some of that concern.
So do you mean for family members who are
who,
the person
that
have brought up the concern? Who
yeah.
Do the hallway pounce?
Because I actually get that not infrequently. And I'm stuck in this quandary because I want the patient to have some insight into their poor driving ability, but in order for them to understand where I'm coming from, it's oftentimes important to bring in the family member and have them also talk to the patient together so we can come to consensus. But the problem that I have, the concern that I have, is from the family member's viewpoint, they're concerned about reprisal from the patient. And I'm not sure if you have any recommendations or if there's really anything that we can do to help to alleviate that.
So when you're having a problem with insight, some of it is just the shock of the whole idea that this is even in question. And so it's also a matter of how we have to kind of step up to the plate and be willing to be the bad guy so that the patients' family members who they have to live with for the rest of their lives are not having to play the role of the bad guy. So I will usually go ahead and initiate the conversation. And if I have never had a driving conversation with this person before, then I will usually use a medical condition or multiple medications or medications that they have as a reason to take the position of trying to advocate and check on their driving skills. So, for example, that there are some people whose heart condition gets to the point where it is affecting their driving, which doesn't seem obvious, but it can affect the blood flow to your head and affect your reflexes. And I would not want anything to happen to you or to anyone else who is riding with you. So I would like to have you evaluated for that and make sure you're continuing to be safe. I understand that you may feel safe right now, but it would be much better to prevent you having an accident with all the expense of repairing your vehicle and having to recover from a serious injury than to have it happen and then we would all regret that we never looked at it in the first place. And then I will give the opening to the family member to see if they do want to say something after saying, well, you know, has anyone said anything to you about this? Have you observed anything where you think their medications or their medical condition might have affected them in any way? And by saying in any way, people can say things to you like, well, they're wobbly when they walk, and I've noticed he's had more trouble seeing when he's trying to make left-hand turns. And it allows you to introduce the concept that it is the disease that is affecting and taking away perhaps the driving privileges. It's not you and it's not the family member. It's the fact that they have a disease entity that's progressing.
So are there resources that you can use for, say, a second opinion, or if you're kind of in doubt, like you're not sure this patient is sort of on the fence from your clinical judgment, is there an occupational therapy evaluation that you can do, or something that might even bring in corroborative evidence to help strengthen your conversation or strengthen your argument or help you make this determination?
Occupational therapy is your first line of referral, because if someone is having specifically difficulty with advanced activities of daily living, so that their job would be not only to evaluate the basics, but anything like cooking, finances, occupational and recreational activities, their advanced ones. If they're having trouble with those, they are pretty much guaranteed to be having trouble with driving as well. And they can do the whole line of cognitive testing that we've talked about. Sometimes speech therapy will do that depending on the clinical setting in which you practice, but those are certainly ones that you can outsource for therapies. And you can also ask physical therapy to look at people who are having mobility issues or range of motion issues. If the more serious deficits are identified, then referring to a driving rehab specialist would be the next step. Now, the majority of those people are occupational therapists, but they're also fairly uncommon and pretty expensive. So that's why I don't refer to them right away. I will refer to other people first and see if we can kind of make a determination one way or the other, or if there's anything that I can fix first. You know, for example, a Parkinson's patient who has been okay at first, but is now progressing even after we have increase their medications and they've gone back to neuro. If they are at the point where they're really wobbly and people are worried and they can't turn their neck, then that's the point where I may need to send them to a driving rehab specialist. And I usually do it from the perspective of explaining that this is someone to see if they can help you continue to drive and stay mobile for longer. They will do on the road. They will have various devices they can recommend, like spinner knobs for people with arthritis or extended mirrors for improved vision, or hand controls instead of foot pedals for people who are having pedal confusion and peripheral neuropathy and can't tell which pedal is which anymore. And so the idea is to prolong people's time in the driver's seat as much as you can to retain their independence and mobility. They are also willing to be bad guys, and they will make the recommendations. They're great at being bad guys, and they are also great at finding alternative transportation. It's part of their job when they're a driving rehab specialist.
Interesting.
Plus, they have dual controls.
And yeah, so they, yeah, so their fear of being in the car, it reminds me of driver's ed. But I wanted to bring up, so we're kind of, so we've, this, our hypothetical patient here, you know, the curbsider family member, Alfred, his, we've identified that he's at risk. Let's say that his clock drawing wasn't great. And it sounds like we're sort of within the app and within the book that you were talking about, there's this like plan for older driver safety. The PODS is the acronym, right? And so we're sort of going down the algorithm here. So we did our screening questions, we did our exam, we've identified this person's at risk. And then I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. It sounds like we can have an occupational therapist or a physical therapist sort of try to work with and identify some things that can be done. And then the driving rehab specialist is somebody that's sort of our last resort, like to keep this person on the road and extend their driving life expectancy, as you call it?
Yes, most people will outlive their ability to drive by 6 to 8 years. And so you want to stretch that out and make it as short as possible. A driving rehab specialist can be helpful earlier on, but if you can fix things before sending them off, it's much more cost effective. They are often not covered by insurance strictly for driving rehab, and those evaluations can cost as much to between $300 and $600, which is a lot to ask people to put up out of pocket.
For something they don't want to do anyway. It's not right. Like they're playing the slots for a weekend. Like they're.
Well, it's something they want to do if it'll keep them going. Yeah. It's not something they want to do if they perceive that this is all strictly harassment. And so that's why it's important to put yourself on their side from the beginning. I am trying to keep you going. I am trying to fix everything that I can. And that's one reason I like to start mentioning this actually way early on. It's good to do in the welcome to Medicare visit. But, you know, if I have a 50-year-old who's having really issues with his diabetes compliance, I do not hesitate to point out that if you do not work on this, you will not be able to feel your feet in 10 years and you will not be able to drive. So I want you to keep driving. So let's work on this a little bit harder.
What are some resources when you're in this stage with patients and their families and you've identified, okay, there's a problem and you're starting to get buy-in, what are some easy resources other than like occupational therapy that we can point our patients to, whether it's websites or handouts or just anything that we can use for our toolbox as, you know, when we're seeing patients with these issues?
The biggest issue is always alternative transportation. How are they going to get around and get to where they want to go if they had to stop driving? And so there's two sort of stop gaps. One is, well, what would you do if you had surgery or an accident and you couldn't drive? How would you get around? And help people to problem solve a little bit right away that way, whether it's taxis or public transit or ride sourcing with Uber or Lyft. There's one, Uber Health now, which specifically focuses on health-related transit. And there's also one called GoGo Grandparents, which also will help arrange transit, including for people who don't know how to use a smartphone. They need a phone that can text and can get a picture so they can identify the driver when they come up. But it doesn't have to be a smartphone. They can do everything else either by voice or using their computer at home or having someone else arrange it. There is, for general transportation support, there's a website called the Elder Care Locator. This is actually good for all sorts of things, for housing, for nutrition, and it's got a menu that scrolls on the right-hand side of the screen, and you can go down to transportation, click on it, and it will give you the contact area agency on aging or any other transit authority in the area you are at by zip code. You put in your zip code first so that you can call people and say, hey, how can I get around? This is my situation. What are my options?
This was actually relates. We had a listener asked about specifically about the ride sharing. She said, "Is there any data or resources for connecting older adults to ride share programs over medical transport?" She said that her almost 90-year-old grandmother-in-law hasn't driven in 8 years. Is now feels liberated that she's using Uber. But is there any data that this is like helping people, or has this been studied specifically? That we were talking earlier about, like, are people being like robbed when they're using Ubers if they have dementia or that sort of thing? Not knowing like where to even tell the Uber to drop them off was what some of the things that were being speculated before we jumped on the call here.
There is not any data-driven analysis or information about crime or people being taken advantage of who have dementia, but that is one of the reasons that Uber Health was specifically developed, because the drivers who are enrolled for that are ones who specifically acknowledge that they're going to be willing to help people enter and exit the vehicles and may or may not be also able to assist with carrying different objects or medical devices that the patient, as we would regard them, but as the rider needs. There has not been one yet specifically developed for mild cognitive impairment, but the Beverly Foundation has developed the 5 A's of dementia-friendly transport, which includes things like assistance and what's called through-the-door transitions and accepting directions from caregivers at each end. And there are several transit authorities and paratransits who are now starting to set those criteria locally and then label their transit as specifically asking whether or not you need dementia-friendly transport. Some states, like the state of Florida, which I am fortunate to live in, has a transportation website called Find a Ride Florida. And in it, you can specify the different conditions that the person has and what you need. And they will provide a listing with phone numbers, prices, and service accessibility for the entire state of Florida. And very few places have it at that level of detail yet. But here in Florida, since we're on the forefront and 25% of our drivers are going to be over age 65 in the next 15 years, we're trying to get ahead of the game. We are where everyone else will be in 25 years.
Yes.
If someone keeps driving despite like family members and doctors telling them you should not be driving, it's not safe, if someone just refuses to stop driving, what are some tactics that we can use to prevent like bad outcomes from happening?
Well, there's refusing and then there's forgetting. What most people try to do at first is take away keys, and keys multiply like rabbits. So my personal best is one patient who turned out to have 11 sets of keys by the time we got them all. Well, up to that point, they lost their keys, and so they kept having new ones made.
Right.
So
probably after key set 6 or 7, that should have been a warning sign. But
I think that's a red flag. Patient has more than 2 sets of keys.
Yeah, that wasn't a good one. An alternative to taking away keys is to simply grind the keys down so the person can put them in the car for the older style car that many people have, which are not strictly key fob operated, but just to grind them down. And then they can put them in, they can jingle them in their pocket, but they just don't work. So they can't get anywhere with it. The equivalent would
that's
be to
dubious.
Put a dead... Well, or to put a dead battery in the key fob. That's the other equivalent. You can park the vehicle at a distance, so it's not a continuous visual reminder of the person. You can persuade them that it would be the pleasant, just, and beneficent thing to do to gift it to a struggling younger adult who is a family member or friend who could greatly benefit from this. you should get people alternative photo IDs, because when they do surrender their driver's license, they're still going to need some kind of real ID for the rest of their life in order to qualify for all their benefits. And most every state pretty much provides an alternative identification to the actual driver's license. If you go in and say, I need to turn in my driver's license, I need identification, they will go ahead and take your photo and give you the new one right on the spot based with that. And then there are other in-between strategies. For example, I had one gentleman with memory deficits who was perfectly agreeable to stopping driving. And we provided him with a letter, and we also provided a prescription in which we wrote down, I agree not to drive, and he signed it, and I signed it, and he took it home, and I kept a copy in the chart, and his wife put it on the kitchen table, which was right next to the door, and he would look at it, read it, and go, oh. And then by the time he got to the kitchen door, he would forget. And he drove to the office for his next visit. Like, how did you get here? And we're like, okay. So the next step was that we enlarged it to 8x10 side, and she put it on the inside of the kitchen door so that he would have to see it when he tried to walk through the door. So he would look at it, read it, and go, oh. Then look down, put his hand on the doorknob, open the door, and walk right through it. So that didn't work so well either.
It's nice to know that you have just as many failures as us when it comes to keeping them from driving.
Well, the third one, which actually did work, was to blow it up to legal size and tape it to the inside of the windshield. And then he would go out, get in the car, read it, and go, oh, get out of the car. Then forget, come back, get in the car, but he would read it again and say, oh, okay, get out of the car. And this would usually happen about 4 times before his wife would catch on to the fact that he was messing around and then go retrieve him before he could go anywhere. Because she still needed the car to get places. Mm-hmm. Now, for people who don't need the car, you can disable the car. You can do the old, you know, pull the wires out thing. But in that case, it's very important to leave a note under the hood which says, do not repair this car until you call me.
Yeah.
So that when people call AAA or the household house call mechanic service, that they open this and go, oh, you know, let me call and check and see if I have the part. And then they call you and you say, no, 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 do not, do not repair this. So I've only had one person go and actually buy an entire new car because they couldn't get their car to work.
Oh my gosh. I mean, these are morbidly funny. It's like when your kid, does something ridiculous. You just, like, your choices are, am I going to get mad or am I going to laugh at it? Yeah. You gotta laugh at it. I know Paul was like, you should have, when you were talking about grinding keys and things like that, Paul's face, I was like, I don't think Paul has the stomach for this kind of work. Good thing he's...
Yeah, no.
Good thing most of his patients aren't driving.
No, I need a better cop than me. I'm not sure I could manage this.
Oh,
well,
man.
You know, your office staff can be great support for this too. If you just leave your handy list of tips with them, and this is where I can put in another commercial. There is a site which is the sort of patient education half of the American Geriatric Society called the healthandaging.org. And we developed 4 companion patient education tips to go with this. And one is just safety tips in general for people who you're trying to help continue driving. And then there's ones which are more caregiver director, which are tips for when should you start talking about this and how do you sort of take a look yourself at whether or not people are having difficulty, like looking for warning signs, like people who are getting lost or ignoring traffic signs or look like they're dozing off or develop road rage when they didn't used to do that with it. And then there's another one which is sort of a guide for transitioning about making a diary and a journal of where it is they go and how they get there and how often, and then creating a transportation plan for how they're going to get the places that they need to get to and who's available to help with that. So,
and I think a lot of those are linked to right from the app as well. I was just under the patient and caregiver resources within the app. It's they're in there as a handout, so you can pull them up on your phone or you can open them on a web page and print them out.
Mm-hmm. And you can also send yourself the 300-page PDF of the entire guide through that app if you really want to. Could take a little bit of memory though.
I do want to ask if you could just briefly talk. I know it's different by state, but if you could tell us a little bit about our legal reporting obligations and, like, am I going to get thrown in jail because I didn't take someone's license away? That's something that I think probably myself and a lot of other listeners would be worried about.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, there's three basic issues, and I would like to tell you that every state has good laws on this, but not every state does. But the three issues you want to look for in your state laws: one is immunity for reporting, so that you or anyone else who reports can provide information, and while you do not remain anonymous to the agency, you remain anonymous to the person who is being reported. So they will know they have been reported, but they will not know who reported them, and you cannot be prosecuted for the reporting itself. In a good state, that includes that you are protected if you have, by definition, breached patient confidentiality by doing so. In a less progressive state, it will not include the language regarding patient confidentiality, and then you're stuck with the conflict between patient confidentiality or not. And so then the third issue that brings up is duty to protect versus duty to maintain confidentiality. And the duty to protect is the duty to both the patient themselves and the duty to protect the public from this person. There is established case law where if you are reporting because you are sufficiently concerned that this person is a danger to the public, that you will not be held liable for that report in terms of a violation of confidentiality. If someone tries to sue you for that, they will lose on those grounds. You can be held liable if you fail to warn. So that's the duty to warn. If you do not warn the individual to stop driving and you do not document that in the chart and they leave your office and they go run over a kid, yes, you can be held what's considered third party liable, that you should have told them that not to drive when you knew perfectly well that they should not drive. And if they then go out and kill somebody, then the family or interested parties of the person who was injured can in fact sue you for failure to perform your duty. And those have been successful lawsuits.
Yeah, that's the scary one. Yeah, that's the scary one.
There's not a lot more to add.
Not a lot more to add.
Yeah, so it's safer, truthfully, to err on the side of reporting than on the side of not reporting. Your liability risk is lower if you report than if you do not.
And this feels like a dumb question, but that's never stopped me before. To what agency are we reporting?
you are reporting.
You've never done this, Paul.
No, actually, it's a great question because it can be a little bit different from state to state. But ultimately,
yeah, it's a great question. Sorry, please continue.
Is the state agency somewhere in your state that has some alphabet soup of letters that include the words D, M, and V, which stand for Department of Motor Vehicles? And it may be highway safety in motor vehicles. It may be traffic in motor vehicles. It may be a division of motor vehicles. But there's usually a DMV, whoever you got your driver's license from, is the people that you report to.
Very good.
They will have a form that they will send you and that they will ask you to fill out that provides them with the basic data they need to recommend suspension of the license, to recommend retesting, or to recommend further evaluation and remediation through a driving course or a driving rehab specialist.
I will say in Texas, it's the Texas Department of Public Safety, which is, it's not a DMV.
Oh, wow. And I have to say that's the first one that I've heard of. So I have learned today. Thank you.
Now, when we report patients in general, does their license get suspended until they can prove that they're a fit driver? They can appeal it, right?
Well, that depends on your state. They do not suspend in every state just based on your report.
Okay.
With it. And actually, the other thing I should remember to tell you is that if you use the clinician's guide, it's got the link to the reporting site in the one in Chapter 8, every state.
Oh, great.
You can go there and it's got the link for it. And so that's in the app too. The issue of suspension is actually to find out what does happen in your state. Because doctors are considered reasonably reliable and not usually cranks who are just mad at their neighbor, generally they'll accept you as being a valid reporter.
Are you saying the most common reporter is a crank, quote, crank that is just mad at their neighbor, is reporting their neighbor? Does that happen in Florida a lot?
Oh, sure. if you run over somebody's mailbox, they will hold it against you forever.
That's fair.
With it, so they can certainly report you if they're just mad at you, and so they have to determine whether or not this is actually a valid report. You know, don't win too many poker games. So once, if it's a physician reporting, it's usually considered pretty valid. And then it will depend to a degree what you say. If you have pretty strong evidence, and usually for most of us, it takes pretty strong evidence to go as far as reporting, then they will usually, at the very minimum, send a retesting requirement. And potentially they can also suspend. Now, the only way they can actually usually take away someone's license or suspend them from driving until they show up for retesting is to send an officer to the house. There are states that will do that. They will show up and they will say, I'm here to confiscate your license, sir. An officer cannot do that unless there's an extreme situation at the side of the road. And there's been actual damage to life, limb, or property with it. You can't make people take away their license. And then most often they'll require retesting. In Florida, at least, when that notice gets sent out and people get reported, probably a good half of them never contest it and never go through all that effort. And so they are automatically suspended. That's not true in every state, but it is in Florida with it. But then they show up for retesting, and then it depends how they do on their retesting. There are people who can be reported who might manage to pass by hook, crook, and looking extremely pitiful at their local Department of Motor Vehicles. And if that's true, you can continue to report. And every time you report, they have to reopen the case.
That was my next question.
They do.
That has to lead to an awkward office conversation. So, still driving? Yes,
well, now...
That's
now,
strange.
So do remember that 50% of people with dementia continue to drive for the first 2 years after diagnosis.
Mm.
And that there's a lot of people out there who will drive without their license.
That has happened, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Well, think about all the other people who drive without their license. Got to get to work. Gonna drive.
Yeah.
Well, gonna have to go find my next case of beer. Got to drive.
I am. Yes. That's a famous patient that Matt and I know about.
Yeah. Yep.
I've wanted to talk about that one, but I'm going to put it to the wayside.
Well, these are the extreme examples. Alice, can we ask you for take-home points? Because we've taken more of your time than you, you've been very gracious, and I want to let you go.
Well, take-home points would be, first of all, ask. Many people avoid asking because they don't want to know, because they don't see this as something they have ownership over. They go, oh, well, that's transportation and driving. That's not my problem. That's social work. But you cannot take care of a patient if they've died in a car crash. So your first job is to make sure that they are alive and able to get to you. And that includes being actually able and willing to evaluate driving. The second one is to start early, like I said, with a younger or middle-aged adult, and link their health care to the fact that this is a necessary prerequisite for continuing to drive successfully, and establish yourself as being on the side of trying to keep them healthy and able to drive. And then when and if it comes to the time where you have to start restricting, then you're not going to be perceived as the adversary nearly as much. And the third thing is, if you sort of think this is interesting, but you really can't remember all this stuff, and it's a lot of bother, and how do you document it, and how do you bill for it? And there is guidance for that as well in the guide and in the app. It's to just ask yourself, would you accept a ride from this person? If not, why not? And what are you doing about it?
That's great. I think that's a great spot to end. And this is, I have to say, before your talk, I had not heard anyone give a lecture on driving. I think this is you are uniquely suited to do this. And I think a lot of people you're going to be the first person they've heard give a talk on this topic. So I'm really excited to share this with the audience.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I really hope that it's useful. That's the big goal here.
It's useful for everyone but Paul.
No, I was just laughing at your insightful statement of me too. Yes, no, it's extraordinarily helpful. It's nice to actually have a framework with how to discuss this. So thank you so much for your expertise.
Yeah.
My pleasure, and thanks for the opportunity. I'm really looking forward to hearing more from you guys.
This has been another episode of The Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
Get show notes at thecurbsiders.com/podcast, or get our mailing list. Get on our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledgefood, and you'll get You'll get a weekly copy of our show notes. You can send us feedback to thecurbsiders@gmail.com, or just reach out on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter at thecurbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And I'm Dr. Stuart Kent Brigham. And good night.
And I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams, and good night.
Oh, hi, Paul.
And I would like to thank Dr. Kate Grant for her excellent cover image for this episode, and Beth Garbatelli for helping to write and produce the show, and to our team of correspondents who help keep the show running. Hannah R. Abrams is on Twitter, Beth Garbs Garbatelli is on Instagram, and Chris the Chew Man Chew is on Facebook. Thank you, and good night.
Good night.